Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Lowy Institute. I'm Michael Fullilove, the Executive Director, and I'm delighted to welcome you to today's event with the Deputy Prime Minister and Foreign Minister of New Zealand, Winston Peters. Ladies and gentlemen, for the whole of our history, the Pacific has been an important part of our work here at the Institute, and the reason is that the Pacific is central to Australia's interests. It's our immediate region. We have important historical ties to the countries of the Pacific, and also we see ourselves as wanting to play a useful and helpful leadership role in the region. And so the Pacific has always been an important theme of our agenda. We've produced influential work on Australia's regional assistance mission to Solomon Islands, relations with Fiji and PNG, future development challenges of PNG in the region. We've hosted prime ministers from PNG and Solomon Islands and other countries. Our current research priorities include foreign aid flows in the Pacific, people-to-people links between Australia and PNG, labor mobility in the Pacific, and of course, the economies of the Pacific. Late last year, we saw the Australian government call for enhanced engagement with the Pacific in the Foreign Policy White Paper, and one of the ways we can engage as a country with the Pacific is through our cooperation with New Zealand. And so we are delighted to host the Foreign Minister tonight to hear his views on the challenges facing the Pacific and New Zealand's role in the region. Ladies and gentlemen, the Right Honourable Winston Peters was born in Whangārei and grew up in Northland. He graduated from the University of Auckland with bachelor's degrees in arts and law. He was elected to Parliament in 1978 in the seat of Hunua and served as MP for Tauranga between 1984 and 2005. He's continued to serve in Parliament as a List MP and member for Northland. Mr. Peters formed the New Zealand First Party in 1993. Following the 96 election, he served as DPM and Treasurer in the Bolger and Shipley governments. From 2005 to 2008, he was Minister of Foreign Affairs and Aid in the Clark government. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Peters has been one of the most significant figures in Antipodean politics in the past few decades. 10 years ago, The Interpreter, our excellent digital magazine, ran a piece with the headline, "New Zealand Election, Winston Peters a Big Factor." It's a rare thing, an evergreen headline, but that was one. But you should be careful tonight, Mr. Peters, because deputy prime ministers with New Zealand citizenship have been getting into a bit of strife recently. Ladies and gentlemen, Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern delivered her first major foreign policy address on Tuesday to the New Zealand Institute of International Affairs. She talked about the importance of the Pacific in that speech, and tonight we'll have the Foreign Minister himself discuss New Zealand's priorities for its engagement with the Pacific in more detail. One of her announcements was that Mr. Peters, in addition to Foreign Affairs Minister, I believe will take on responsibility for disarmament and arms control, issues that have been themes of New Zealand foreign policy for decades. Ladies and gentlemen, let me introduce the Deputy Prime Minister and Foreign Minister of New Zealand, Right Honourable Winston Peters.
Michael, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for the invitation to be here this evening and to say that no man's a prophet in his own land. And hence, giving a foreign policy speech in Australia is an enormous pleasure to me, and thank you for the invitation. This is about the Pacific and how we see it going into the future. And so this speech is entitled, "Shifting the Dial, Eyes Wide Open, Pacific Reset." New Zealand's coalition government was formed with the intention of leading change rather than a managed, modified status quo. We had the choice of carrying on as before, doing the same things as we were before, not just on the land of New Zealand, but offshore as well, or to do something far more dramatic, which we believe the country wanted. From domestic policy through to foreign policy, the coalition intends to shift the dial. This energy and desire for action also informs a reset of New Zealand's foreign policy direction in the Pacific, which is the theme of today's speech. But first, there are certain geographical, historical and social facts about New Zealand. We are a Pacific country linked by history, a culture, politics and demographics. One in five New Zealanders, approximately 1 million people, now have Maori or Pacifica heritage, and this demographic trend is growing. These basic facts have profound consequences for how the New Zealand government of 2018 regards the Pacific region. This government is intensely engaged in the Pacific. Over 30 New Zealand government agencies have some form of interest or engagement with Pacific Island states, as do a number of non-governmental organizations. In many respects, the Pacific is where New Zealand matters more, wields more influence, and can have more positive impact. We see in 2018 a region challenged by a dizzying array of social and environmental problems, and one attracting an increasing number of external actors and interests. So much is changing the Pacific, and sometimes it is not for the best. Need and temptation often leads to greater risk than prudence would suggest. It's also a region of opportunity and empowerment where Pacific countries want to stand on their own two feet as equals, make their own choices, and have their distinctive voices heard on the global stage. And for all these reasons, we regard it as critical for New Zealand to embark on a new re-energized Pacific strategy, a re-energized approach based on New Zealand values and increased technical and financial support to the Pacific, a re-energized approach also based on greater coordination of effort by all New Zealand stakeholders with an interest in the Pacific, with Pacific governments and people, and with key partners near and far. It'll be a strategy based on mutual respect, underpinned by a set of guiding principles and with our eyes wide open about the challenges and opportunities before us. To deal with Australia to begin with, this is where we are. Let us start with noting the visit of Australian Foreign Minister Julie Bishop to Auckland just a few weeks ago. It was a welcome chance for us to have a discussion about where we might focus our interest into the future. Personalities do matter, but policies matter more. That meeting and recent events has underscored the Trans-Tasman shared instincts for the Pacific region. Our collective response, for example, to Tropical Cyclone Geeta was a visible demonstration of how Australia and New Zealand work seriously well together. Immediately, both of us deployed Defence Force assets to airlift emergency supplies to cyclone-battered islands. In the case of some of those islands, our forces were ready to go before the cyclone struck. And as we move from the emergency response phase to long-term recovery, both countries are dedicating expertise and resource to helping our Pacific neighbours in their time of need. Now, our reaction to these events required no reservation at all. It was a natural reaction in their hour of need. It is also a simple reflection of our shared geography. Another recent example is when both Australia and New Zealand were at the forefront of searching efforts for a ferry missing in Kiribati. And while seven people were saved, many lives were lost. This tragic incident further emphasizes how the Pacific's very worst moments, when they happen, its neighbors, Australia and New Zealand, are always there to help. So let's acknowledge the huge role Australia plays in the Pacific. Australia is by a considerable margin the Pacific's largest donor. And in the context of broad Pacific challenges and a complex strategic environment, we in New Zealand acknowledge Australia's influence for the greater good of us all. And with more regional instability and global uncertainty than at any time in living memory, Australia and New Zealand need to be very clear-sighted about facing these challenges together, because we have never, since 1945, needed each other more. It's not a matter of a country cousin or the senior soldier anymore. We're in a serious struggle to get on top of the problems we have in the Pacific, and we seriously need the best efforts from both of our countries. And so why is the Pacific important to New Zealand? There are three reasons why New Zealand regards the Pacific with such importance. First, Pacific identity, and in particular, New Zealand's Polynesian character. There is greater interconnectedness between New Zealand and the countries of the Cook Islands, Niue, Samoa, Tokelau, and Tonga than any others in the world, with the possible exception of Australia. Now, whilst these countries might be small, and disparate and isolated. The reality is they occupy a serious part of the world's space, and it's becoming more important every day. And the second reason is national security. The modern world opens transboundary security challenges, including gangs, criminal deportations, which we can't say too much about tonight because it's the wrong place to say it in, drug production and distribution, cyber and financial crime, and aviation and border security. New Zealand's national security is directly affected by the Pacific's stability. And third, shared prosperity. Pacific Island countries with improved economic and social well-being create opportunities for themselves to improve their resilience and self-reliance. We seek to assist Pacific Island countries to achieve sustainable economic growth and improved public financial management as the primary engines of lifting living standards and funding vital government services. And it shouldn't be underestimated just how much change is underway in the region. This being a second time as New Zealand's foreign minister is a time for reflection because a lot has changed in just 9 years. It's become increasingly obvious that the perception of New Zealand by Pacific leaders is changing. This reflects a new generation of post-colonial Pacific leaders who are increasingly confident, independent, and assertive regionally and internationally. They are more comfortable in courting a range of external partners. These dynamics are changing New Zealand's relative influence. At one level, we are moving from a post-colonial influence to a mature political and development partner. At another level, we have to work harder to maintain our positive influence. Pacific perceptions of New Zealand are also being shaped by our different patterns of engagement across the region. In Polynesia, where our political, cultural, and historical links are much closer, New Zealand is certainly viewed as a family member. But in the Pacific overall, it has become an increasingly contested strategic space, no longer neglected by great power ambition, and so Pacific Island leaders have more options. This is creating a degree of strategic anxiety. Our country, which is the Pacific's second largest donor, accounting for around a tenth of the total development spending in the region, is not alone in grappling with new realities. It is the same question Australia, the European Union, the United States all pose to themselves. We need to better pool our energies and resources to maintain our relative influence. Now, in navigating a more complex strategic environment, New Zealand's view is that we must be respectful of the Pacific Island countries and their clear wish to manage their own international relations, while at the same time retain New Zealand's traditional emphasis on human rights, the rule of law, transparency, good governance, and the promotion of democracy. Our wish is that accountability across the Pacific embodies these tenets, because we know that good leadership is good government, and what we need is more good political leadership to lift performance across the region. But make no mistake, isolation and a lack of size is no excuse for failing to strive for the best of standards. And that's a message we have to get clearly through the Pacific from end to end. Being small and isolated is no excuse for failing to strive for the very best. Pacific Island countries, however, face multiple challenges, which in some cases they are not well equipped to tackle and where leadership is lacking. New Zealand is a small, realistic, and pragmatic country. We know we cannot help the Pacific solve its problems on our own. Is there will always be someone with deeper pockets than ours, and some Pacific leaders are attracted to easy sources of funding. And if any of you know of the seductive experience of traveling in some parts of the world, it is mind-bending for some young politicians. It's probably why in Roman times, when every Caesar was chosen, someone was asked to walk next to his chariot and every 10 minutes say, "Remember, you're only a man. Remember, you're only a man." Well, we need that in our part of the world as well. At the same time, New Zealand is proud to be full members of the Pacific family and to have played a significant role in assisting the region to meet its challenges over the past generation. As part of the Pacific family, New Zealand is conscious that our identity, our national security, and our prosperity are inextricably linked. We have, in a very genuine sense, a shared Pacific destiny. For these reasons, the new government in New Zealand is undergoing a Pacific reset. We must, we need, and we should be doing more to make a difference in the region. The Pacific reset will have two distinct strands. The first approach is what young people describe as old school because it requires back to basics diplomacy. Renewed Pacific diplomacy is why Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern, myself and other cabinet ministers plan to spend considerable time in the Pacific during 2018 and beyond. It starts next week with the New Zealand Pacific mission to the Cook Islands, Niue, Samoa and Tonga. Much of next week's visit will be assessing the recovery and rebuild work required following Cyclone Gita. But we'll also use our discussions to share perspectives on the strategic environment facing the Pacific, including the proliferation of external actors. We just have to get a better dialogue of understanding where people put their cards on the table. Under our refreshed Pacific policy, we are adopting a set of five principles to chart our diplomatic interactions. The New Zealand Cabinet has agreed to these principles to steer our Pacific diplomacy. First, demonstrate a depth of understanding of the Pacific shaped by academic community, civil society, and private sector expertise that exists in New Zealand. Second, to exhibit friendship, including honesty, empathy, trust, and respect. This means staying in frequent touch at a political level and having a frank and open conversation when necessary. And it also means, I think, that we need to focus far more on the Pacific, as I suspect our two countries have been preoccupied with other parts of the world when building on our borders are matters of serious concern. To strive for solutions of mutual benefit when developing domestic and foreign policy with impacts on the Pacific is our third target. For example, pension portability, criminal deportations, climate change, labour mobility and health and education policy. Fourth, to achieve collective ambition with Pacific partners and external actors on a shared understanding of what we are trying to achieve together. Finally, to seek sustainability by focusing on the region's long-term goals, to play our part in promoting greater autonomy and resilience amongst our Pacific friends through their improved economic and social achievement. Now, diplomacy will take us a long way, but not all the way. The second strand in New Zealand's Pacific reset is putting money where our mouth is, which will be welcome for all voters who hear that statement. It's to put money where our mouth is. The Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Trade has not had in my country a budgetary increase since 2008. Restoring lost capacity is one of our chief goals in advancing New Zealand's foreign policy interests. We hold the view that while New Zealand has demonstrated remarkable nimbleness and effectiveness in recent years, its diplomatic corps needs to be rebuilt. We need appropriate funding to have the right people on the ground, around the world, but in the Pacific in particular. New Zealand also has some work to do with overseas development assistance, as our credibility as a humanitarian donor is becoming stretched, and no foreign minister wants to admit that. New Zealand directs 60% of its development spending to the Pacific. This ratio is becoming more important, but New Zealand's aid spending has declined in comparative terms over the past 9 years. As a proportion of gross national income, it declined from 0.30% back in 2008 to 0.25% in 2016, and if it's not arrested, it'll fall to 0.21%. For a nation that prides itself on being a responsible international citizen, that is simply not good enough. That's why New Zealand must, over the term of this government, reverse this recent decline by expanding the size of our official development assistance program to help our Pacific neighbours improve their resilience and, through that, their autonomy. Now, there may be no votes in this, but it's the right thing to do, and it shows New Zealand's seriousness in being an active and good neighbour. A significant shift would, among other things, allow New Zealand to bolster our efforts to tackle priority issues for Pacific people, especially climate change, which is an existential threat in its own right for some island states, but also enable an increased focus on sectors important for the promotion of our values, including good governance and transparency, human rights, women's political and economic empowerment. And before some internationally fritter away this sentiment, we're one of only 9 countries, and Australia's one of them, that can claim an unbroken line of democracy that's holding election every set term or earlier since 1854. Only 9 in this world. And in terms of values, as far as we're concerned, it counts for something. And it would provide also an increase in New Zealand's funding to the multinational institutions, the World Bank, the Asian Development Bank, both vital institutions that, alongside donor states, can offer sustainable investment choices for Pacific nations. This is a shift that starts now, particularly given that in 2018, we have a critical juncture occurring in the Pacific. During this year, the Cook Islands, French Polynesia, Fiji, and the Solomon Islands will all hold elections. Papua New Guinea will host APEC, Nauru will host the Pacific Islands Forum, and Fiji, as current president of the Conference of the Parties on Climate Change, will lead the international community in the important Talanoa Dialogue, a process designed to increase global ambition in the fight against climate change. The world's focus is therefore on the Pacific like never before. And so, in terms of future direction, New Zealand will embark on a refreshed approach to the Pacific, the islands and its people, one motivated by our understanding of the scale of the challenges of the Pacific and stemming from existential climate change issues and ever-present poor economic and social outcomes. While the size of New Zealand's official development assistance program is under reconsideration, as we speak and preparing for our budget in May of this year, we intend to shift the dial to move our Pacific relationship past the donor or recipient interaction and into genuine, mature political partnerships, and expect New Zealand to approach our Pacific neighbours with understanding, friendship, mutual benefit, and collective ambition to achieve sustainable results. This reset expresses the trajectory of New Zealand's history, its independent foreign policy, and is shaped by our close relations in the Pacific region. Now, this was said before in the speech, but it needs to be emphasized tonight again. There has never been a time since 1945 when Australia and New Zealand need to work together in the Pacific, because we are the leading parties, interests, and value countries in this part of the world. Our emphasis on leadership diplomacy with the Pacific will manifest itself by undertaking frequent ministerial travel into the region, providing a high degree of political access to political leaders who visit New Zealand, and to ensure that we have frequent discussions with those who are working with us. And this Pacific refocus has the intention of working closely, as I said, with Australia and other regional partners with the objectives of tackling the shared big challenges in the region, and they are big, and shifting the dial on them. Thank you very much.
Minister, thank you for doing us the compliment of not only speaking to us, but giving a substantial and wide-ranging speech in which you set out your views on the Pacific, and you made some announcements about how you propose to refresh and revitalize New Zealand's approach to the Pacific. One of the comments I was interested in was you talked about the Pacific being a more contested geopolitical space, and you talked about great powers taking an increasing interest in the Pacific. You didn't mention China, but let me ask you about China. Late last year, you may recall the Australian Minister for International Development and the Pacific drew a lot of headlines by referring to Chinese aid in the Pacific. And she spoke about Beijing funding roads to nowhere and standing up useless buildings. I can see you smiling. Do you agree with the Minister? And what do you think are the positives and negatives of Chinese aid to the Pacific and its increasing engagement in our part of the world?
Well, part of the speech was titled Eyes Wide Open. And the political system of both of our countries needs to be honest about what it knows it's seeing. That what it portends is serious in terms of our way of life and who we are. Some of us in this part of the world have not given up or think the game's all over. or presume that we cannot win. We've always believed that democratic and value judgments of like that in politics go one long way, and that we are still capable of being the predominant value influences in this part of the world. Now, I noticed that minister wasn't a foreign minister, if I can put it that way. And if you're going to make a statement, perhaps you should not offend both parties, the donor and the recipient. Because that's exactly what happened. Remember? Got all the Pacific people up in arms and got the Chinese up in arms as well. We'll try to be much more subtle than that.
To encourage you away from subtlety. let me ask you one follow-up on question on China, if I may, and then I'll invite some other questions from the audience on the Pacific. I was very interested in a comment I saw you make recently where you were quoting Janis Joplin in relation to China, and you said something like, "Freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose." Now, obviously, that's a great song, but what were you talking about? How is Janis relevant to China?
Well, it's been my observation as someone who's tried to understand China and has enormous respect for China, far more than probably many people I know, because of how I've observed things in terms of historical study. And I take them as far more seriously than many as to what their influence would eventually be. After all, it was Churchill that described the circumstances by saying of China, "China's a sleeping dog, let it lie." He knew full well what one day would happen if it ever was to wake up and organize itself, and we're experiencing that now. But that said, when you go back, say, 20 years ago, when you have a change in state ownership and businesses and you're facing having to find 180 million people a job whilst you restructure, right about then you start seeing dimensionally how big the problem they've got. And what I was trying to point out, that a whole lot of people are critics of China at one level or dead scared to admit what they don't think is right on another level, and neither of it's helpful. I've understood China when I say that, because what does it matter to someone that you're going to have first world rules and values if you're starving? And that song comes from Bobby McGee, and it's a famous line. Freedom's not, just another word for nothing else to lose when you're hungry. And in the case of China, I'm one that's prepared to give them a chance to reorganize in the hope that one day modernity in economics would lead to modernity in politics. Now, it's taking one long time, but there are some signs that it's emerging. In the meantime, though, that should not stop us, when we see things that we don't like with what China's doing, from being upfront and saying so.
Just to ask one follow-up on that, I mean, many critics of China would say that the developments are going in the opposite direction, that prosperity is not leading to more democracy, but the opposite. You're seeing a tightening of surveillance, for example, in China, increasing personalization of authority in the person of Xi Jinping, who may well be the president for life, and also a greater assertiveness of China outside its borders. So what is the role for Western democracies like New Zealand and Australia that have an important interest in engaging with China, but at the same time, as you say, structure our societies in a different way? How can we nudge China on some of these questions?
Well, the first thing we must do, though, is defend ours, our two countries, and the Pacific's resources. In a resource-starving or hungry world, there's a massive struggle going under the guise of politics and all sorts of initiatives. But it's about resources, and we need to defend our own. Because if they're in the control of some other country, our capacity to be of help to anyone will quickly diminish. And there are some signs of that in my country, sad to say. But the second thing is, when you say that there, how do you in the end shut people down who have this critical thing called information and knowledge? And having talked to some very senior Chinese politicians, I do perceive that they are more acutely aware and more driven by the need to lift their people's standards and feed them than ever before. They're very aware that if should they not be able to do that, then this could turn into a crisis for them. And I think that's far more widespread in the psyche of the Chinese governing party than we actually think. And the other evidence for that is when something goes wrong in China, like in a railway station where 129 people get murdered, and this is not infrequent behavior, this is common. And also, if you go out west, the very west of China, you will be amused how similar they talk to Tasmania. You just have to ask them, is Beijing treating you right? And they'll give you 2 hours of what the hell's going on in Beijing. It's so common and similar to us. So it's not all hopeless. That's my point. But I would hope that there's more guts, courage, and honesty in dealing with the Chinese, and that's what respect deserves.
All right. Let me invite some questions from the audience. Let me start with Anna Kirk from the Lowy Institute.
Thank you very much for your speech. My name's Anna Kirk. I'm a research fellow here at the Institute, and I manage a project called the Australia-Papua New Guinea Network, which is working to enhance the people-to-people links between Australia and PNG. And I was curious on your thoughts about the different attitudes and approaches to the Pacific that New Zealand and Australia take, and why you think that we do take these different approaches.
Well, first of all, Polynesia is different to Melanesia, and Melanesia is different to Micronesia. But the biggest difference between those three is Melanesia. And there are acute psychological and cultural matters of understanding that one must have when you're dealing with them. I think it's absolutely critical. Polynesians are a bit like different. I somewhat liken the Polynesians to the Green Party in New Zealand. That is, well, it's not a put-down, but they'll talk and talk day in, day out, but they want to resolve it in the end, right? Whereas, you know, Melanesia can be very much big fella talk. You've had all the talk, and all of a sudden someone makes a devastating decision, you think, where was the consensus that led to that? I'm not going to point to any one country. But I think that we have to really better understand who we're dealing with if we go into the Pacific from here on in. There is a commonality with Polynesia. But I think there's an adverse commonality when it comes to Melanesia. And the problems are so much bigger. And it's very worrying also that the propensity for untoward political decisions based on personal preference to be made. Because you've got to remember, in the Pacific, there is that view. Actually, you'll find it in the Old Testament. If you can't help your own, who can you help? It's a judgment of how good you are, unfortunately. It's a recipe for corruption.
Just to follow up, if I can, on Anna's question, what about, do you think there's a difference in the way that Australia and New Zealand treat the Pacific? I mean, you mentioned the Melanesia-Polynesia difference, but some critics would say Australia's a bit haughtier, less empathetic, perhaps.
Look, it's not just Australia. I can recall circumstances where I saw people being treated in a way that was bound to leave resentment. And it goes simply like this. I mean, women understand it, men don't. Women know what it's like to be treated as inferior, not being regarded as equal. And boy, those Polynesian and Micronesian, Melanesian people are super sensitive, and they can evaluate your view of them and your treatment of them very quickly. And for all my failings, I can tell you I've done my utmost to ensure that when they see us, they know we think that they are equal. Otherwise, we're never going to be partners.
Good evening, Mr. Peters. Thanks for your address. Ben Doherty is my name. I'm from the Guardian newspaper. You're also the Minister for Nuclear Disarmament, a reinstated portfolio. New Zealand has signed the Nuclear Weapons Ban Treaty, but New Zealand's also a US ally in ANZUS, member of Five Eyes, all of those things. Australia has said it won't sign the Nuclear Weapons Ban Treaty because it relies on the US alliance and the US nuclear umbrella. Do you believe Australia's position can move? Do you believe Australia should sign the Nuclear Weapons Ban Treaty, and can it remain a US ally and sign that treaty?
Look, it's not a cop-out, but I'm not going to come to Australia and tell Australia what its foreign policy should be. I'm just going to put my bona fides out there as a politician decades ago who was living with the neither confirm nor deny policy, only to find in the late 80s that policy under the guise of no nuclear weapons and capability was come to this country was an outright lie. And when we found that out, as a member of the National Party, I put it on the agenda and had it changed in 1989. We've remained the same as across the political divide. There is nevertheless the support for the non-nuclear decisions that New Zealand made in 1985. But I'm not going to tell Australia what they should do. But I do say this, that we have to strive on three levels, chemical, conventional, and nuclear weaponry, to see a dramatic turn down and change. Otherwise, the future is a nightmare. And North Korea right on our doorstep now.
Hello, thank you for your talk. My name's Lucy. I'm an intern at the Lowy Institute. You mentioned that New Zealand has limited aid funding and that a lot of new donors have a lot of cash to splash around. China is perhaps one example. And I was just thinking perhaps one solution to this in terms of diminishing New Zealand's influence and also poor and guarding against poor project outcomes is trilateral projects such as the Te Mata Vai Water Initiative in the Cook Islands. I was wondering what your opinion is on trilaterals and if New Zealand is going to be pursuing more of these in the future.
This is related to a conversation I had before I came into this room, but you picked a rather bad example. And I can't say why now, but that's a Chinese project, and we've got problems, that's all I can say. Big problems. I agree with you about trilateral and multilateral aid programs. I would like to do my best to get Switzerland and other countries involved in this part of the world and helping out as much as they can. If I can get Boris Johnson, the English, to give me 1% of their foreign aid, that's 280 million in this part of the world. It'll go one long way. I'll be seeing him about a month and a half time. Don't you write that down just in case he thinks it's coming. But when you look around, there are people who are that we could enlist their support for. It's sad, though, that you've raised the project which goes to the quality of the product. And it's enormously alarming to hear it because that is the difference between the Rarotongan Lagoon being in pristine condition or being capable of being brought back to pristine condition or not. And if that fails, tourism in Rarotonga will fail dramatically, be a massive loss. So we can see a huge aid bill coming for us that should never have happened. But I really meant to tell you that our objective is to set a target of aid in a respectable level where we should be at 0.7%. And we were last anywhere near that in 0.5% in 72 to 75. We were heading towards 0.35% in 2005 to 2008. And then we started regressing into not putting the money up and not helping. It'll cost us if we carry on doing that, and it'll cost the Pacific as well.
Chris Hamer, World Citizens Association. There's a trend towards regional integration around the globe, countries cooperating to solve their common problems. I'm wondering what might happen in the Pacific. What do you see as the future of the South Pacific Forum? And might it develop into a community, say, on the European model?
Well, it's a fascinating question because the moment the British left the EU or made the decision to leave the EU, they discovered the Commonwealth again. They rediscovered 2.2 billion people who had the capacity to help them in their plan for the future. And that is the probably widest regional or multinational thing I can see of our historic background. We will open up an embassy in Scandinavia shortly because there is serious regional cooperation in Scandinavia and there's a lot we can learn from it, and we think that a country like New Zealand should be placed there to learn those lessons. In the Pacific, I don't believe that we could start a Pacific Parliament or Pacific body like that, but we're going to have to beef up the forum and beef up all the institutions and put more money into it, and above all, do our utmost to find the top quality men and women, because that will make or break the plans we have into this part of the world. A promotion of the best possible people is surely on our agenda. How come Australia and New Zealand promote the best possible netball players and league players and rugby players and not the best people in politics? Maybe we've got our priorities wrong here.
The next hand I saw was Ewan Graham, also from the Lowy Institute.
Foreign Minister, my question relates to the one that was asked earlier about your portfolio as disarmament minister. You mentioned North Korea. North Korea is a country you know. You've been to Pyongyang. You've talked to them. Do you really think there's a realistic prospect of nuclear disarmament? Would they be prepared to give up their nuclear weapons, and under what conditions? The second challenge I'd like to ask about is maybe a more subtle one. The Australian government's position officially is reliance on the United States for extended nuclear deterrence, but there is an undercurrent here, a beginnings of a debate about whether Australia may in future need to acquire its own independent nuclear deterrent. What does that say about how close New Zealand and Australia really are? Are we really on the same page when it comes to our strategic worldview?
Well, if you are answering the question downstream, and nuclear power nuclear might capacity was the future of North Korea, then you're certainly going to get countries like Australia asking whether they should be equally capable. That'll be a disaster. But you asked me, first of all, did I think North Korea could be changed? Yes, I do. If North Korea, with the positive involvement of China, realizes there's no other way out but to stop the nuclear development program, and if there was a secondary factor, that is, enough countries prepared to change their economic outcomes and put the money up and bankroll them for 10 years to make that change, in the same way as, for example, East Germany became part of West Germany after and Helmut Scholl made that great change, then yes, it's possible. But they have got to be left with no alternative but alongside a serious carrot for change, because no regime, they say, Turkeys don't vote for an early Christmas, and in their case, they will not change unless they can think there's a way for their future, in my view. But they'll never change unless it is clear as anything, with China's massive involvement, that this is the end of this pathway for them. I'm confident it can happen, because to think any otherwise is just really unthinkable.
Can I ask you a question relating to that, Minister, about President Trump? President Trump is obviously one of the key players in relation to the North Korean dispute. And there's an interesting debate that's opening up about whether President Trump's foreign policy has been as bad as many people predicted. Obviously, he continues to tweet and throw discontinuities into the system. But then a lot of other commentators point to the continuities in US foreign policy and what Mr. Trump would call the deep state, keeping US foreign policy on the straight and narrow, at least when it comes to Asia. As a newly minted foreign policy, how do you feel about the US role in the world at the moment? And what are the implications of having somebody like President Trump, who's so different from all his predecessors, as the leader of the free world?
Well, look, first of all, I do have considerable time for Rex Tillerson. I think he's a seriously talented, qualified, highly experienced personality who's doing it for reasons totally remote from ego, that he's doing it to serve his country, and I think we should be grateful that the United States has got a person like that. Now, as for a tweeting president, well, with the greatest respect, if you're the leader of the free world, and you believe that your culture has values and class to offer by way of image, I'd get off the tweet. Just leave it alone. I mean, this is not some social engagement in some downtown on a tired night on the weekend. This is about the world's peace and security. That's all I'll say. It's not something that we in New Zealand find, in terms of advocacy, a very persuasive element. But I don't want this to be this headline tomorrow. That'll be rather sad.
All right, we've got some other hands in the air. I'll go to that gentleman, and then I'll come to Jonathan Pryke from the Lowy Institute and that lady as well. Yes?
My name's Carl Claxton, Minister. New Zealand led the Bougainville peace process 2 decades ago. Have you turned your mind to the target date for the referendum next year?
Well, it's funny you should say that, because I remember your former Prime Minister Downer and Don McKinnon at the time putting a lot of work into and effort into the last Bougainville uprising or contretemps, whatever you might describe it. And we have turned our mind to it, but we're not certain what we're seeing here. Certainly Foreign Affairs in New Zealand is not able to come up with a great conclusion at this point in time of exactly how it's going to happen, when it does happen, and what it all means. And all I could probably say is we certainly have not published anything to that effect the way that you expect me to make the answer right now. I think we have to see things with far greater on-the-ground clarity as to what's going to happen.
Bran O'Sullivan, New Zealand Herald. My question relates to Belt and Road, and the previous government signed a memorandum with the visiting Premier of China last year, fairly anodyne one without too much flesh to it as to what that engagement would be. Has the coalition given some thought to what its stance on Belt and Road is, and how will that play out in relation to the Pacific? Any concerns about the implication there of Belt and Road?
Well, I have to say that I do regret the speed with which the previous government signed up. They couldn't have known with any great depth exactly what it was, what it all meant. It was a highly organized publicity exercise, and very recent in its formation in terms of public advice, even though it was sort of discovered by the Chinese or rediscovered by the Chinese in 2013. And that said, I do not feel that we should be bound because the previous government signed up to something. Let's face it, we've all got belts and we've all got roads. Well, Europe has. The United States has. Japan has. What is actually new here?
Let me call on Jonathan Pryke, who's the director of the Pacific Program at the Institute.
Thank you for your most welcome presentation this evening. The Australian government has also committed to a step up or a step change in our relationship with the Pacific in the last few years. I know you're not here to tell us what to do, but friend to friend, what do you think we can learn from New Zealand's engagement with the Pacific? What do you think you do well that we could adopt and do more of?
Look, remember General Douglas MacArthur's complaint? It was that his country was far too Euro-focused and was not in any way grasping the problems that were up in the Pacific until it was all too late. And I kind of think we've got that version coming on now with respect to both Australia and New Zealand, if I might say so, and including the United States. All I'm wanting to say from our government's point of view is we look at Australia, you're right to be concerned about the whole world, the Middle East and every other part of the world. But don't forget your neighbourhood, because in terms of, I think, emphasis and priority, it would not be a criticism to say that our view is that it has not held hitherto, until your last white paper last year, the same preeminence in recent times. Now, you can criticise us as well, but we are concerned because we are south of you to ensure that Australia gives it the same priority as it does with, say, Japan, as it does with its Asian appearance, and also your institute as well. You just told me you're going to go worldwide and examination all of the interchanging and interlocking countries and communities and cultures in the world as part of your study. Well, don't forget this part of the world, because it's the size of it that matters, not just the small populations.
Ladies and gentlemen, I think that's the perfect note on which to end. One of the most powerful theme, I think, of the minister's speech today was don't forget your neighbourhood, and that's a message that's very well taken. Minister, I think if I'm right, this is your first visit to the Institute. I certainly hope it's not your last. We wish you well in your new role. We thank you for not only speaking to us, but giving an important speech full of important things for us to chew over. I think it's a speech that will be closely read in capitals around the Pacific over the next few days. Thank you also for explaining the Janis Joplin lyric to me. I'm reminded, I think, of not me and Bobby McGee was a great song, but so was The Times They Are A-Changing. And I think that's the other theme of your speech, that the times are a-changing in the world and in the region, and it's time for countries like Australia to step up and try to guide them in the direction that we want. So, Minister, thank you very much for speaking to us. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in thanking Winston Peters.
Thank you.